like to share these recordings with you.
Welcome back to the Maintainer Podcast, the show where we shine a spotlight on the people and stories driving fleet readiness at Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center. Today's episode takes us from expeditionary repairs in the Caribbean to down below the waterline with our dive shop. We talk about the leadership behind cutting-edge combat system modernization, and finally, get into the heart of what service before self really looks like. So check your gear and check your buddy's gear. You're listening to the Maintainer Podcast. To start things off, I'll turn it over to Commanding Officer Captain Dan Heminger. Recently, the Navy announced the reconstitution of Shore Intermediate Maintenance Activity, or SIMA, Norfolk. It's a move that reflects where we've been and where we're headed as a maintenance enterprise. Captain Heminger joined us to talk about what this change means for Marmec, our workforce, and how we continue our mission of fixing ships. Over to you, Captain Heminger.
Good morning, Team Marmec, and welcome to the Maintainer Podcast. We've kicked off the new year with a bang, leaving 2025 in the rearview mirror. 2026 promises to be a challenging year, but I have the utmost confidence that this team will meet each task and mission requirement with the steadfast commitment and professionalism that I've witnessed every day since taking command. I'd like to reserve some time here to talk to you about a critically important organizational change being executed by Marmec. In December, our CNO directed the establishment of two new Shore Intermediate Maintenance Activities, or SIMAs, one in Norfolk and the other in San Diego, by June 1st, 2026. These will be standalone commands with a strategic focus on enhancing fleet readiness and developing sailor self-sufficiency through hands-on technical training. The reconstitution of SIMAs is a critical element and the cornerstone of CNO's broader effort to build and sustain a battle-ready force. Last month, our ISIC, Commander, Navy Regional Maintenance Center, directed the establishment of transition teams in Norfolk and San Diego. Those teams include departmental leadership and subject matter experts from throughout the command who are well underway executing a detailed plan of action and milestones in order to meet the overall objective of establishing a standalone SIMA by June 1st of this year. As we progress towards the ultimate goal, we must remain focused on the guiding principles of this transition. We must prioritize mission effectiveness and sailor development over efficiency. The organizational design must support the primary goal of training sailors, restoring technical competence, and building self-sufficiency. We've got a great episode lined up for you today with more interesting topics featuring some of our very own heavy hitters, including an exclusive interview with two of our very own Navy deep sea divers from the Marmec Dive Locker. They're going to share some incredible insights into their critical work below the waterline. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay focused, and thanks for your unwavering dedication and selfless execution of our mission of making ships ready. CO out.
Thanks, Captain, for helping us better understand how this evolution strengthens our ability to support the fleet today and into the future. Let's rewind to December of 2025. Nine sailors from Marmec board a plane bound for the Caribbean, carrying tools, expertise, and a mission to support USS Iwo Jima and USS San Antonio. These repairs weren't happening pierside in Norfolk. They were conducted during Operation Southern Spear, a Department of War-directed mission focused on disrupting drug trafficking and defending the homeland. Helping to lead that effort was Lieutenant Commander Spicer, who reminds us that in today's Navy, there's no distance too far and no job too complex for the talent at Marmec to tackle. And now I'll hand it over to Public Affairs Specialist, Oscar Pope.
Lieutenant Commander Spicer, thank you for joining us here today on the Maintainer Podcast. We got you here to talk about the mission that you guys undertook during Operation Southern Spear down in the Caribbean, some repairs that took place. And we want to talk about how you did that during a Department of the War directed mission to disrupt drug trafficking and protect the homeland. But before we get into these three sections, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I enlisted in the Navy back in May of 2000, spent 14 years as a nuke on carriers, commissioned via the LDO program, went to the surface repair side once I commissioned, did a tour as a DCA on an LPD. Since then, I've done Chang on LCS, Chang LSD, done a tour at NSERV. That's about it. Was the last LDO they sent through department head school. in order to be a TAO. So I got that, the SWO side of that, that aspect. So that was a very challenging school, and it was fun. And I learned a lot in that one that made me realize a lot of things about the Navy and kind of put me into a little bit more of a SWO mindset with an engineering kind of drive.
That's a strange mix.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
So how long have you been a ship repair officer here at Marmac?
I've been here since June of 22. So, yeah, roughly like 18 months, give or take.
And you're getting ready to transfer somewhere else pretty soon.
Yes, I leave in April, May timeframe of this year to go to USS Essex to be the chief engineer on board there out of San Diego.
They will be thrilled to have you.
I appreciate
you've done amazing things here for Marmac so far. All right, so let's dive right into it. I know we talked before, we conversed via email, and you mentioned that distance and complexity aren't limiting factors. So how do you prepare the team of nine sailors with civilian support? How do you prepare them to tackle such a major structural repairs thousands of miles from their home port here in Norfolk?
A lot of it's communication that we get from the ship. What do they need? What equipment will they be able to provide? Vice, what do we need to take with us? For instance, you mentioned Hull Branch. Brian Myers, the civilian APS there, does a fantastic job of looking at the job, scoping it out, briefing our guys what they need to do, along with Lieutenant O'Neill and the HGC Baker and Chief Potts, who were the two that went over for that. So with them and then Jamie and those guys, they have a really good idea that once they get there, what's the scope of the job already? And then communicating with the ship to set everything up for us really expedites and assists us in getting the job done quickly and efficiently.
Yeah, and these jobs that you mentioned, I understand they were related to like what, the plenum bulkheads, bolted access points, and bulwark doors. Explain to the listeners what were the extent of those repairs and what does it mean?
So a lot of the fasteners we'll have to remove because they're already warped or cross-threaded or anything. So we cut those things off and then we re-weld down some new stock in order to support the structural portion of it. As far as the bulkheads, those are usually our toughest jobs, usually require doublers. A lot of that has to do with watertight integrity, makes the space safe. A lot of times you can go on a ship and you'll start to see the deck is warping based on the fact that the rust and stuff from the bulkheads in the deck have right. completely gone. Right. So it you know, it's for safety of the crew and as well as the structural integrity of the ship so that they can maintain their mission.
Now, in terms of mission readiness, if these specific jobs weren't done, what would have been the impact?
The plenum would be unsafe. You could have potential of equipment falling through. You could have personnel getting injured, which is the last thing that we want is our sailors. Anything happening to them while we're underway, especially on deployment like this where you need everybody that you have in order to meet the mission requirements.
We also learned that you did some non-destructive testing.
That is right. We got with Code 135 with Mike Kubicki and his team. They were awesome in providing a NDT personnel to go out and actually do some of the testing that we were able to do, which is a rarity for us because a lot of that's localized, mm-hmm. but they were able to support with the work that we had going on over there.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more. So you've got the NDT testing in this expeditionary environment. How is it different from doing it locally here in Norfolk?
We can do a little bit more here locally in Norfolk than we can over there based on the equipment that we have. To travel with some of that equipment, it would be large and costly to get it over there and on the ship and would require more time. So we're kind of a little bit more limited on what we can do overseas as of over here locally. But for what we needed for this one, we were easily able to meet that mission.
Yeah, like you said before, there were absolutely no limiting factors.
None.
Glad you were able to pull that off, you and your team. So describe to me about this close coordination, and I'm throwing up air quotes because close coordination is something that a lot of people don't understand the extent of it. When you're here locally in Norfolk and you have ships out thousands of miles away, close coordination will probably be an understatement.
Yes.
So talk to us about that coordination that you had with the ship's force.
That was all via email and phone calls. Whenever they could get somewhere and we could reach out and actually get the extent of what we needed. Some of that, too, is with the jobs that they write. If it's not very detailed, it kind of leaves it up in the air what we have to do. So then making those phone calls, those emails to get more clarification so that we can do it, which a crew that is already functioning, that their mindset is drug ops, like you said, was supporting maritime missions out there. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're kind of like, okay, we're coming out here to help you. What do you need specifically? And that's where that close, the communication portion came in.
And these guys were already mid-mission.
Yes.
You know, already underway.
And they were overtasked and, you know, they were tired. So us coming in to,
right.
to leave that burden from them in order to help make these repairs was, I think, essential for them to be able to continue their mission.
Absolutely. Be able to focus wholly on the mission without having to worry about things that you could otherwise fix.
Yes.
We'll talk about the civilian involvement at technical depth now. So Marmec is about 3,000 military and civilian personnel, roughly. So while the nine sailors were on the front lines of this mission, your guys, what role did the civilian technical experts play?
They provided the guidance that we would need it if we ran into a, let's say, for instance, we ran into a the material or something, or the scope of the job wasn't the same, and we needed to reach back and say, okay, hey, look, this is what we're seeing now. What do we need to do? So that technical guidance, that proficiency that our sailors don't necessarily have because they're only here temporarily. As we talk about, we're here for 3 years, whereas the civilians, they are the quintessential, like...
The continuity.
The continuity. There we go. Thank yeah. you. The continuity that we need in order to do ship repair. I mean, between them and the sailors buying into We Fix Ships, I mean, it's extraordinary how they all work well together in providing the knowledge and the training that our sailors need to make our fleets better.
Absolutely. We talk about the problem-solving mindset of the civilian workforce. So how did your civilian experts help train and mentor the sailors who are deploying for these rapid response missions?
OJT. I think that's a lot of it is they get it in the shops and they get it on the ships. Like I mentioned, Chris Armbruster and Jamie and Brian Myers, along with Mike Kubicki and all those. I mean, Sam Landis over in the inside machine, who wasn't really involved in this, just providing that training with the sailors because they're all prior chiefs, senior chiefs. Prior enlisted who understand what needs to happen on the ships and how to get our sailors ready to go support that.
Definitely some salt there.
There is a lot of salt there.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's jump into the strategic impact and a look into the future. So this mission obviously supported the president's priorities for homeland defense. How does having a mobile maintenance capability directly impact the success of anti-drug trafficking operations?
Oh, it's essential. If we can go over there and make the repairs, we allow our ships to stay longer. They can go out and do more missions. They can support whatever missions we need. Again, just making those repairs to keep them out there as long as possible is essential to, I guess, that's the success of all of our missions.
Right. So if, say you got your nine guys out there and they're doing their mission and they're getting exhausted, is there a backup team that
we
could
do.
Probably
we
go
have,
out?
Again, you mentioned we have 3,000 people. We can send other people out there. A lot of times we give those guys a little rest before they get out there because they know they're going to be hitting it hard. So they'll get a little bit of a break. And then when they get back, they'll get another one. But we do have personnel that we can always send as backup if the job requires more and more work. But again, a lot of that comes into the communication portion that if we realize that nine people aren't going to be enough, mm-hmm. we already have other people identified that we can send out to assist to make that as less stressful and make it more streamlined as possible.
Now, I want to plug NAMPS here. How does NAMPS play in all this?
NAMPS is their way of actually learning how to do their job between rewinding a motor, which is a new one we started, to the hull branch portion of it, the welding, the brazing, to pump repair. That's a big one.
Right.
Watertight door repair. Every ship needs that.
Absolutely.
Especially with, you know, most of your DCPOs are not engineering types. They're all TAD from other shops. So they don't really have that background. So having that repair capability on the fleet and that we can send out as an alternate, that helps out a lot.
That's amazing. So looking into 2026, how is Marmec evolving this training that you mentioned to ensure small specialized teams continue to fix ships wherever they are needed globally?
Just getting people qualified. That's the big thing is pushing the NAMPS program, making sure that they're meeting the requirements that they need so that we can build those teams. And at the same time, when they leave and they go back out to the fleet, now we've built that redundancy into the fleet. So that now they're projected to do a lot better, be able to do a lot of these repairs on their own so that now we're limited more to the high-level repairs that are needed, vice, hey, can you come fix, you know, a couple valves or something
right.
that the ship could
right.
do.
So if you want to leave us with some final thoughts, what do you leave us with?
Well, I would say that fixing ships is a priority, and I think that Marmec as a whole has been an eye-opening experience for me because before I got here, I was really unsure what Marmec really did. And I kind of, you know, doubted a lot of what they do. But now that I see the greatness that's here and the people, the training that's involved, the leadership, I just want everyone to realize that I understand the ships, like there's a lot of things they could do themselves, but we need to help them. The Manning's not there. The Manning's not here. but the knowledge is here that can assist those guys in the development of the fleet. And that's kind of like what I wanted to push, the training, the over the shoulders, a lot of that, in order to make the fleet better along with our sailors.
Definitely glad that you finally become a believer in what we do here at Marmac. And I would say you definitely had a big part in that.
I appreciate that.
And our success here at Marmac. So obviously me and every listener out there wants to know, what's your favorite podcast?
Oh, obviously the Maintainer podcast.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Whether it's structural repairs, non-destructive testing, or engineering reach back, this mission shows how sailors and civilians across Marmac form a single mobile maintenance capability with strategic impact far beyond the shore in Norfolk. Modernizing a warship's combat system isn't just about software and hardware. It's about people, precision, and timing. Our next guest, Lieutenant Commander Geis, recently earned the Program Executive Office Integrated Warfare Systems Excellence Award. During her time as Aegis Test Officer for Marmec, her Aegis Modernization Team delivered 4 Baseline 9 ships back to the fleet in under 3 years, setting new benchmarks along the way. Shaving off weeks from modernization timelines and pioneering virtualization that will defend future combat systems, this is what technical excellence in action looks like.
So we're here today with Lieutenant Commander Elizabeth Geis, also known as Beth.
Yes, happy to be here.
Yep. First and foremost, congrats on your earning the Program Executive Office Integrated Warfare Systems Fiscal Year 25 Quarter 4 Excellence Award. That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. Thank you.
But before we get started, tell our listeners a little bit about you.
My name is Beth Geis. I commissioned from the Naval Academy in 2013 as a SWO. So I served 2 SWO tours out in San Diego before I lat transferred to be an engineering duty officer. I attended NPS, and then this is my 3rd EDO tour. I was previously at NIWC PAC, and then IWS/Marmec for Aegis Test Officer, and then now I'm serving at Marmec as a DEG division head.
You said NPS. What is NPS?
NPS, Naval Postgraduate School.
If you're listening out there, we're going to go through a lot of acronyms here, so we'll try to spell those out for you.
Sounds good.
So from your perspective as an officer here, what is it about the specific technical DNA of Marmec sailors that allows the command to tackle such complex modernization tasks?
The modernization piece that I've been familiar with involves the push of this modernized equipment from the program office to be installed in these ships during avails, whether that's a shorter avail, would be a smaller package, or up to a longer avail, which would be the Aegis modernization baseline upgrade, which I'm familiar with as the Aegis test officer. But in order to make sure our ships remain lethal and fighting force for our Navy, these sailors, particularly those at Marmec, need to help maintain these systems, get all bugs, kinks worked out, whether it's material, software, and to make sure that the fleet has a ready, capable system to fight whatever adversary is out there. So Marmec sailors are integral in that they need to maintain these ships between these modernization and yard periods, make sure the fleet has available assets that can beat our enemy.
Right. So what I hear is the technical aspect is that experience, that know-how, that teamwork to tackle these complex modernization tasks with ease.
Yes.
Right. So you delivered 4 baseline non-ships back to the fleet in under 3 years. How does the collaborative environment at Marmec empower the Aegis test officer to achieve that kind of high tempo output?
So these complex DMPs where I was involved in for the whole Aegis baseline upgrade are 2-year-long availabilities that are very complex from the repair side and the modernization side. In order to be successful, a whole lot went into planning these avails from the Marmec team, the planners, the PARMs, all those modernization entities coming in to put their equipment into this package. And then a lot falls on the shoulders of those Code 300 personnel who are executing the avail with the support of all of the codes at Marmec to make that code successful. So it's extremely complex work packages that use essentially all of Marmec to make sure they are successful so that we can deliver the customer, Fleet Forces, the product at the end of the availability, ready to go out to sea and fight our enemies.
Right. So you talk about collaboration. That sounds like a lot of meetings back and forth, smoothing out a lot of kinks on this evolution. So collaboration piece is paramount, would you say?
Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk about the USS NITSI and this 28-week benchmark. So the Aegis Modernization, AMOD for short, 1.0 testing reduction strategy on the USS Nancy successfully shaved 3 weeks off an otherwise standard 30-week timeline. What were the most significant technical or leadership bottlenecks you and your team had to overcome that compressed the 28-week schedule?
So this initiative was in support of the Get Real, Get Better campaign. And what can we do? The program office has been doing Aegis modernization upgrades since mid-2000. So the test program has always been about 31 weeks. And the effort was to see if we can reduce this test package. There are 68 plus test procedures, which are really complex tests within this 31-week test window. And so our effort were to see what we can streamline, what's redundant, and what's being accomplished in, say, other SOVATs, and what is being accomplished in other tests. For example, after these Aegis modernization availabilities, the ship admits their basic phase called C-SQUAT, and some of this testing that we do in the AMOD period buys down risk for the C-SQUAT team. And so we just try to look at redundancies and what should be accomplished during the availability window and what can be shifted primarily for C-SQUAT. And some barriers that we received as we were trying to do this pilot initiative were a lot of stakeholders who truly cared about the product and what all these tests accomplished and how much it reduced the risk for giving a absolutely capable, kink-free system to the warfighters. And if we were to shave any of these test procedures away, they felt that it added risk to these sailors. However, there's a lot of analysis to be done that some of these tests were redundant. So that brought down the risk. And it was just tough to get everyone on board to make sure that we were all on the same page to accomplish this initiative.
Yeah, awesome. You mentioned Get Real, Get Better, that initiative. And it sounds like, you know, being able to shave off 31 weeks down to 28 weeks, it's quite a feat. It causes you to get real and get better in terms of, let me see where I can improve and not waste time. So it really speaks volumes of the efforts of your team to really look at their practices and trim it down to something that made a lot more sense to get this ship out and modernized on time and ready.
Agreed. It was tough to shake up the status quo and to have everyone in the mindset that we need ships out on the waterfront ready to go on deployment, and we need them to be capable, yes, but we also need to do what we can to shave off time and get these ships out on time or better.
That's right. Turn two, commence ship's work.
Yes.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about the USS Lassen. We'll talk about the future of virtualization, something that is a little bit challenging for some people in the technology field. Virtualizing things is a little bit intimidating. So the USS Lassen was a trailblazer as the first ship to complete the Red Hat Enterprise Linux 8 CP24 test program with the infrastructure as a service, IaaS, virtualization. So with that in mind, and for those unfamiliar with the tech, why is moving forward with virtualized combat system a game changer, air quotes, for the warfighter?
It is a game changer because, I mean, all of us, we've heard this analogy, I'm sure, that you hold up your iPhone in the middle of the night, you get software updates. Tesla cars now get software updates in the middle of the night. Why is it that our ships that are out there in the fleet, why do they have to wait 2 years approximately to come in the shipyard and get any type of upgrade, except a quick software change that can be done in a smaller period of time? And so this initiative to virtualize the combat systems is a step in the right direction to be able to provide the latest capability to the fleet and actually push that out to these fleets who are forward deployed. Again, this is another instance of people have been operating how they've been operating for a long time, and this new technology has risks and unfamiliarities, but we need to get the capability out there so that we can get key pieces that we need to send to the warfighter at the front lines. And that was the first step to do that on the East Coast on the USS Lassen. And I mean, we definitely had some speed bumps as we were installing that program load and testing it. But since there's half a dozen, if not more, ships on the East Coast that have this virtualization on them, and the program office is learning a whole lot and that capability is growing, it's really going to be a good asset for the fleet.
Right. Definitely a growing capability, virtualization. Like we talked about before, the work on the Lassen is, it's now the benchmark of the future of baseline 9 ships. So how does it feel to know that the procedures established by your team are now the blueprint for the rest of the Navy?
It was such a rewarding tour to be on the Aegis modernization team. And I was impressed every day coming to the office. We worked in the office with NSWC, Port Hueneme personnel, as well as Lockheed Martin contractors. And I would notice like, oh, I haven't seen this one technician in a few weeks. You talk to them. They had flown out to the Red Sea to support a DDG out there, fix a CASREP. And they've come back and they had stories to tell. And it's just so neat to see our team members who are coming to work every day in our building on base, walking down the pier with us, are also supporting the sailors out in the fleet all the time. And I think it was just really exciting to see that the expertise and the knowledge and the care and the passion of those people in our office. And I just felt so privileged to be working with them every day.
Absolutely. It's always a benefit to have a team that's passionate. And I think there's a huge part of what contributed to you receiving the PEO IWS Excellence Award, which is a significant career milestone. So, Commander, looking back at your 32-month tenure with the Aegis Modernization Team, what is the single most important lesson you've learned about leading high-performing technical teams?
The most important lesson I learned is that I am not the technical expert coming into this job with these personnel. Sometimes they had decades of experience, but I was enthusiastic every day. I cared and our team knew I cared. I had no problem asking questions. I had a great personnel I could go back and bounce ideas off of and get a good feel of where our team needed to go. So I just trusted our team and had great leaders around me. We made tough decisions sometimes and finished four avails, which was really exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely humbling to be surrounded by a lot of talent, especially in leadership. You know, I interview a lot of people and they talk about how humbled they are to just be around such talented people.
I definitely felt humble every day.
Commander Geis, thank you for being here. And I'll ask you one final question. Your favorite podcast?
Of course, my favorite podcast is the Maintainer Podcast. Thank you.
Congratulations, Commander Geis. Stories like these are a blueprint for the future. Empowered teams, smart risk-taking, and a culture that refuses to accept good enough when readiness is on the line. Most maintenance happens on ships or in shops, right where you can see it. But some of the most critical work happens in places where you can't see it. Our dive shop operates below the waterline in an environment that demands trust, discipline, and total reliance on your shipmate. ND1 Toomer and ND2 Simonini sat down with public affairs specialist Harrison Cox to talk about what drew them to the diver community, the challenges of the training pipeline, and what it's like to perform repairs underwater when communication is limited and precision is everything.
All right, everyone. My name is Harrison Cox, and I'm here with some of our Navy divers here at Marmac. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
So if you just want to go around the room and just do quick introductions for everyone.
I'll start. My name's ND2 Simonini. I've been a Navy diver for 2 years here at Marmac.
I'm ND1 Toomer. I've been a Navy diver here for about a year now.
How long would you guys say that you have been in the Navy?
Well, I joined in 2014, October. So I just crossed 11 years.
Okay.
This past October.
Yeah, I joined the Navy in 2023. I went to boot camp and then to dive school and was in dive school for pretty much the remainder of 2023. And then halfway through that summer, then I checked into Marmac.
This is your first command?
Yeah.
And I mean, you've been in the Navy for just a little bit, right?
Yeah, about to hit 2.5 years.
Being a Navy diver, you know, obviously is a pretty cool thing. You know, would you say a pretty small community in the Navy?
For sure.
What inspired both of you to become Navy divers?
Well, for me personally, I had an older brother that was already in the Navy as a corpsman. And when I was in college, I wasn't really feeling the school thing. And my brother was actually trying to get into the DMT program. So that's the corpsman dive medical technicians.
Oh, okay.
So he was going through that process. So that's the only reason I even knew Navy divers were a thing. And I knew I wanted to join the Navy. And I was like, I just thought, all right, sounds cool. Let me do that. I had never even dove before.
Oh,
in
wow.
My life.
Wow.
Or swam laps in a pool. Like I could survive in the water, but I never even swam laps in the pool.
So it was like a pretty big difference. Like it was a pretty big learning curve.
For a little bit, yeah. But they have a pretty good program when you're depping into the Navy. You get matched up with a dive motivator and wherever in your region, they run like workouts Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and they teach you how to do the strokes and you run through the fitness test and they kind of set you up for success before you get into boot camp and the whole pipeline.
So what about you? What inspired you to become a Navy diver?
Yeah, so I come from a Navy family. Both of my grandparents, my mom's side and my dad's side, both my grandfathers were in the Navy. And I knew pretty early on that I wanted to serve I didn't know exactly what that process looked like, but I played college soccer. I played soccer my whole life. I knew very early on that I always liked being part of a team. And I knew that when I did make the decision to join the Navy, that I wanted to be a part of something special. And I did hear about the Navy diver and dive teams. And then, like you said, the DEP program, I had a Navy diver chief named Chief Duffy. He was super motivated, just a good guy. He really inspired me to, you know, put out basically for the team and get ready and see what that life looked like.
Being a Navy diver, you have to be very physically fit, and the training is pretty tough, right? So could each of you share your most vivid memory or the toughest single moment you both faced during the training pipeline to be a diver?
Sure. So for me, it actually was in dive prep, which is where you go directly after boot camp in Great Lakes. And that's where most of the attrition really occurs. But there you have to tread water and like the deep end of a pool with scuba tanks filled with cement and a weight belt. And you have to do a specific procedure written out on a job sheet and the exact steps they tell you to while you're treading with all this weight, while instructors are like splashing you with water in your face. And I was pretty decent at like the land workouts and like push-ups, pull-ups, all that stuff. But when it came to treading with weight specifically, it wasn't really my strong suit. And the one ticket to Panama City is treading with weight, essentially.
Gosh.
So doing the, it's called the IWP. So doing that was probably the hardest thing for me. You get 3 or 4 days of practice where you start with empty tanks and then you start with just a weight belt. And then you do what's called man day, where you do all the weight while the instructors are splashing you. I failed everything up until the graded one, my second chance on the graded one.
Wow.
So I was on my last chance and then I finally passed.
He's not really given man day the respect it deserves. like same thing. His class was probably like 10 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mine was just 2 years ago, and I'm imagining that it's the same. Ours was filled with lead, not cement, our tanks. And it was the first time you really get the feel of scuba tanks, like the twin 80s on your back. Mm-hmm. And you have your dive buddy. So anytime you're doing anything in the water, you have your dive buddy with you.
Right.
And you two are basically checking each other, making sure that, you know, your gear's on correctly, right? That you've donned everything, that
no twists in your straps, leaks, hypothetical leaks.
Right. That you're, you know, just making sure your dive buddy's good, right? Your head's above water, you're getting good air, everything's good. And the instructors are coming around, they're splashing you in the face, yes, they're kicking you in the legs, they're pulling your straps, right? They're tying knots in your gear, they're tripping all your gear, they're taking your mask off, flooding it with water while they're doing all this organized chaos, right? To disrupt you, get you, you know, flustered, get you gasping for air, the heart rate up, everything like that. But you're, you know, finding your composure with your dive buddy. You're repeating the verbal commands. Yeah, it's all very precise. You have to say the right thing at the right time. You have to do everything symmetrical with your dive buddy. Because, you know, it is, like he said, that is the ticket to get to Panama City, where dive school really happens. That's the culmination of the 8-week selection period, right? It's assessment and selection, dive prep. It's 8 weeks, and like you said, it's where the attrition happens. We started with 51, and we had, I think it was 7 divers go to dive school.
Oh, man. Right. Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty big.
Yeah. And so that's like you said, that's the ticket. So after you make it through IWPs, that's that in-water procedure, that's where man day happens and everything like that, then you get the ticket to go to dive school and actually breathe that compressed gas. And that's what you're working for.
Gosh. Sounds pretty tough. Glad it's y'all and not me, you know, so.
Right. No, it's a, and then, you know, once you make it through like that, you know, that ticket, that's where the magic happens at dive school. Yeah. Like it's incredible. It was the best time of my life. I was just laying in bed like a couple of days ago, just reminiscing on how much fun, like the smell of Panama City, like the beach, the, what the barracks felt like. I mean, and you're with your best friends, right? Yeah,
yeah.
No, you know, you're tired, you know, you're going to be wet all day.
Right.
I'm speaking for myself, but I know you can attest it is the best time ever.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So there's definitely, you know, like that level of mental toughness that you have to have before you even get into dive school, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. To pivot a little bit, we're going to talk about just a typical day for a diver at Marmac. What does that look like?
Okay, so for me, if we have a job that day, we have one of our tag checkers. So it would be like a younger guy, like Jack over here, he would go check tags on, let's say, a sub. If we're doing a job on the sub, he'll go on board, check diver safety tags just to make sure any of the components on the ship that could injure the diver in the water are all red tagged so that no one can operate them. And then While he's doing that, the supervisors get paperwork in a package to conduct the job, get the dive team together. We get on our boat, prep the boat. Once we get word that the tags are complete and the ship's ready for us to come alongside and dive on them, we get the boat underway, transit over. And then at that point, you're just working the job. It varies greatly based on if it's a, you could have a short job that might take a couple hours. You could have a job that spans 5 days diving all day, every day.
Man. Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of like the generic day-to-day if you have a dive job. And then if we don't have a job, it's a lot of training. It's like we have a bunch of guys at the chamber right now doing chamber drills with the master divers to get qualified.
Would you say the same thing for you?
Yeah, he's spot on. I'm not in a supervisor role, so I'm kind of doing more of the, like you said, checking tags, setting up the dive gear, pre-diving it, post-diving it, getting in the water. Yeah, working out. That's a big one. I start every morning with workout. We have a mud pup program here. That's right. Where we train the guys. Me and a couple of the junior divers are the instructors over there. We'll do that in the mornings, and then the real day starts, whether it be checking tags, doing drills, or anything like that.
So going back to talking about the immense amount of work that the dive shop does on a day-to-day basis for the fleet, talk to me about like a challenging job that both of you had to work on.
I got one off real.
Send it.
So for me at Marmac, the dive team deploys, and we got word that a ship needed underwater blade change, right? So the destroyers have two blades, and they have CPP blades. They're big propellers, right? And so a lot of the times these propellers can take damage, and it can inhibit the ship's ability to do their mission, right? And so this ship was in the Middle East, and they were leaking a bunch of oil, and they needed a dive team ASAP. So we got word that they were pulling into some port in Saudi Arabia, could not find it on a map, and they said they needed a dive team. So we had Marmac divers deployed to Bahrain. That's where I was.
Okay.
They said, we need a dive team 24 hours a day. We need, you know, day and night dives. We need to get this job done. So they flew us out there, and we set up shop in this foreign port. And we had, you know, armed sentries at the gate, made a barricade of Connex boxes. It was a forward deployed maintenance repair.
Yeah.
You know, it was really cool. So we got out there. And we were diving all day and all night. I was on night crew. It was hard work, and it was with the guys. Like in training, you have your dive buddy. You're down there figuring out the problem. You know, you got whatever's going on in the water. You got fish. You got sea life. Whatever it is, and it was great. It was great for the entire team that was out there. It was forget about everything else. Let's come together right now. Let's get this job done. Let's get the ship back out so they can do their thing.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's what we did.
So it was work, but it didn't feel like work.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
Sounds like a very important job. And, you know, I'm sure a big thing while working underwater on a big job like that is communication. So how do you communicate underwater? Let's talk to me about that.
So here we dive what's called surface supplied. So we have a big air system below the deck on our dive boat that we then run umbilicals from. So we have 300-foot air hoses that also have a comms whip integrated into them that plug into a comms box in our dive boat, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then if we dive the helmet, or we dive, so KM97 is the helmet we use, or we could dive Mark 20, which is just a face mask, but both of them have microphone assemblies and earphone assemblies that we plug the comms into that comes off our umbilicals. And so you can just talk like normal. And then you have a guy on a radio up top, and you just kind of talk to the divers back and forth.
And I know that you guys have like hand signals and stuff like that.
Mm. We all know sign language.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, talking about all the immense work that the Marmac divers do for the fleet, just talk to me a little bit about how the dive shop impacts the mission of fleet readiness. You were talking about the big job in the Middle East for the blade repair, which is, you know, a huge thing. Of course, you know, that's like a red line ticket item for the ship. So just talk to me more about, you know, how the dive shop impacts fleet readiness.
Well, I think a perfect example would be the Iwo Jima, USS Iwo Jima. We worked on them this summer on their rudder seal. It felt like around 3 weeks, 12 hours a day. And they were involved in the actions that went down in Venezuela.
Pretty big.
And the president was put on the Iwo Jima.
Right.
So that kind of is a good way for us to see like the work we're putting in actually has some sort of results. Because sometimes you're working all these days, you're doing what seems like random jobs and all these ships, and then they just leave. And you don't really know what is going on, I guess. Yeah. And so to be able to actually see like, oh, the Iwo Jima, which we spent so much time on and so much work, actually was involved in a pretty high stakes operation.
Yeah, I mean, being in Virginia, it's the largest fleet concentration that the U.S. Navy has, and boats are always coming in, always pulling out, and they have these jobs that they need the dive teams to do, and there's only so many divers, so it does become a lot of work when they're pulling in and pulling out.
Being a Navy diver sounds like, you know, it's a very important job, and I'm sure there's a lot of rewarding aspects to the job, but what is the most rewarding part of this job for each of you?
There's a lot of job satisfaction, and like I said, seeing results from the work you do. So like for here, it would be, for example, the Iwo Jima, or we did work on the Lincoln that took 12-hour shifts, single valve stuff, and they were planning on leaving, so that's holding up a whole aircraft carrier strike group.
Right.
So seeing results from the work is really satisfying, but then also, I mean, the main thing for me is the people, and like he was saying, the team aspect. A lot of people that become divers are similar-minded, sort of similar backgrounds, former athletes or like the boys, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that culture starts with that selection program and then going through dive school. Like, we all have this common background that, like, it takes a type of person to become a diver.
Like when he was saying with the Saudi Arabia job, embracing the suck with your friends makes the suck significantly easier, and it almost becomes fun.
Yeah.
In a sense, even though you're working 12-hour shifts at night in this random place.
Cold, dark.
You're all just like, well, we know this sucks, but we're just...
I got my best friend right next
to me.
Talking
crap, you know, all night.
It's cold, but like we're all cold, you know?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's okay.
Definitely.
So that actually leads us into the next question, talking about the backgrounds and everything like that. Thinking back, what is one piece of advice that you both would give your younger self just starting the whole dive school process?
Tread more. For dive school, for me, it would be just to tread more, but... What I would give myself advice would be actually when I got to my first command after everything would be to shut up, listen, and just do what people tell you to do and don't have an opinion until you've earned the right to have an opinion,
right?
Essentially. That's what my advice would be.
What was your first command, by the way?
Kings Bay.
Okay.
That's the Ohio class submarines. That's a base for them on the East Coast.
Nice.
Yeah.
What about you, Indisu?
I don't know. Take more pictures, you know, really pour into the guys around you. I know that when I was going through the training pipeline, a couple of my friends like just fizzled out, right? And so there was a time where I just like wasn't pouring into the guys around me. And so if I could go back and tell myself to do something, like truly enjoy everybody that you're getting to go through this special time with.
We were talking previously about just being a good guy, the weeding out process for being a Navy diver. And there are a lot of important qualities that I'm sure Navy divers have. But what would both of you say is the single most important quality that a person needs to have to succeed as a Navy diver?
I would say, in general, mental toughness, the ability to, like we talked about, embrace the suck without crashing out, essentially, and being an issue. I've seen it in Kings Bay. Like I said, we got a new guy and we were doing a prop change on an Ohio class sub, which is a very large propeller.
For sure.
At Kings Bay, you have one dive team. Here we have Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. So you have four. And we were working 12-hour shifts with minimum manning on each dive side. And we had a new guy literally just break down and like crash out and scream because he just couldn't handle like how much it sucked, like working that much.
Dang.
So there's that.
Yeah.
I think mental toughness. And then a lot of other commands, salvage, SDV. So working with like NSW, you have to deploy on submarines and you just sit there for months doing nothing on a submarine. That's pretty challenging on your mental toughness. So that's what I would say, mental toughness and humility.
Definitely. That makes sense, though. I mean, you got to have a tough mental state for a tough job. What about you?
Yeah, trust. They got to be trustworthy and they got to be willing. You'd never want to leave service with someone you don't trust.
Right.
So you definitely want someone that's trustworthy, and then you got to have someone that's willing. Like you said, there's a job that needs to be done, whatever it is. If it's SDV, if it's mobile unit, if it's salvage or maintenance, there's a job that needs to be done, and only some are able to do it, right? So you really got to take that to the core, and like you just got to want it. You really got to want it.
Indy 1, Indy 2, thank you again for coming in. This was a pretty cool segment, I would say. I'm always a fan of the dive shop. We just want to showcase your story and your work that you guys do. So thank you again for coming in.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Of course.
Our final segment features a sailor who represents the best of our Navy, on duty and off. In 2025, Chief Ollie Dunlap was recognized with the Bob Feller Active Valor Award. Named after a Hall of Fame player who put his career on hold to serve during World War II, the award honors community leadership, patriotism, and selfless service. Chief Dunlap's impact reaches from the engine room to the community, mentoring sailors, supporting STEM education, and building bridges between the Navy and the public we serve.
Chief Petty Officer and proud recipient of the Bob Feller Act of Valor Award. Chief Dunlap, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
But before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I was born and raised in Hawaii, graduated from Waianae High School, joined the Navy, spent my 19th birthday in the Navy, been in for 22 years, married to my wife, Sheena. We have 5 kids, also been married the same amount of time because I literally got married like 2 months after boot camp. I proposed to my wife and we've been married ever since. Been stationed from Hawaii all the way to here, Norfolk, Virginia. The Navy keeps moving me east.
All right. So can you tell us a little bit about the award, the Bob Feller Award? What is it?
Hey, so the Bob Feller Award, he was a veteran, remarkable person within the community. He joined the Navy as a result of what happened at Pearl Harbor. He was able to get advanced all the way up to Chief Petty Officer. He definitely embodies the definition of what it is to be a sailor and to volunteer within the United States Navy.
Thanks for that, Chief. That's exactly what I get out of it. You know, definitely, you know, I understand him to be a former Chief Petty Officer who was an outstanding military professional. We're grateful to have, you know, one of our own to receive his award, showing leadership in the community. So first of all, congratulations, right?
Thank you.
So can you share what it means to you personally to be selected for the Bob Feller Act of Valor Award?
It's definitely an honor and a privilege to be considered for this award. Bob Feller is a remarkable person, sailor, and human being.
So definitely this is a historic moment for Marmac, right? You being the first Chief Petty Officer here to receive this honor. How does that feel?
Oh, it definitely feels amazing. I feel blessed and humbled to even be mentioned in the same category as Bob Feller. So it's a testament to pretty much the team that I'm able to work with here at Marmac. My supportive family, also my church as well, and then also Marmac STEM program.
Right. And then you're deeply involved in STEM.
Correct.
And definitely that continues to, you know, shed the light on your dedication to, and devotion to duty by you being active in the STEM program, which Marmac touts is one of the programs that projects us in the future to form and mold future talent. Would that be accurate?
You're right on the money, spot on. The community outreach that we do essentially not only inspires the kids to want to learn more about STEM, but I can honestly say, like, working with civilians and also military personnel, they have also gotten their families into STEM. I've also gotten my family into it to just inspire some curiosity, just to want to learn a little bit more about the subjects and also, you know, to get hands on with actual particular projects.
Absolutely. Now let's take a look at your personal journey. So looking back at your Navy career, were there any mentors or moments that help shape the leader you've become?
So some names that come to mind, now retired Senior Chief Michael Cook. He was my first LPO on the USS Hopper. He showed me what it is to have the definition of resiliency. Not everyone is fortunate to be on a command that goes off without a hitch. It's pretty much like the next sailor up type mentality. I was placed in a position to where I was stationed aboard ship to where my first LPO got in trouble, like not even my first 6 months of being there. So he was actually my first LPO. I consider him to be my first LPO because he was the first one that showed me the true definition of leadership. So he's definitely a name that comes to mind.
Yeah, you mentioned that your mentor redefined resiliency for you. What challenges have you faced along the way and how did you overcome them?
Some of the challenges I have faced, I guess, would be reestablishing my relationship with my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That's definitely a testament to a lot of my friends and family who continue to advocate for me in prayer. And through that, I think it definitely helped me to find a balance that I needed to have, not just in and out of uniform, but also at home and within the community as well.
It's definitely having a relationship with that regard with your spiritual faith. It's a true testament of this award and why it was given to you. It seeks to point out individuals who embody the character of leadership and community service.
Yes.
Servant leadership. Mm-hmm. Better said. So what messages do you hope other sailors, especially junior sailors and fellow chiefs, to take from your recognition?
So every sailor or human being, you have the ability to leave a legacy wherever you're at, whether it be your place of employment, your school, or any type of community, type of outreach program. You have that opportunity to inspire others to continue on a legacy for future volunteers to continue their service as well.
Now let's look at your leadership and your legacy. So the Chief Community is built on a tradition of mentorship. How do you see this award inspiring a future generation of chiefs specifically?
Looking at the definition and the legacy of what Bob Feller left behind, it definitely motivated me to want to just to become a better person as a whole. And how I was able to do that was essentially just to kind of commit to just being of service every day and treating every day as, hey, I can only handle each task at a time, so I'm just going to continue to do that. Also in combination with trusting the partners and your sailors and civilian employees that, or your team as a whole, essentially to trust that they're able to come through and you're all collectively able to work towards the same mission will definitely help you out as far as trying to figure out whatever goals you need to accomplish.
And in that same vein, if there was one piece of advice that you would give sailors in aspiring leadership, what would it be?
You got to grow every day. You got to shoot to learn something, whether it's learning from the good and bad examples that you see each and every day, but figure out a way to implement that into your everyday life. There's always like a fun-filled saying that I always like to incorporate, that no one likes to know it all. So if you're going to learn something, figure out a way to apply it to your life as well.
So you shout out your mentor. Is there anyone else you'd like to thank for helping you along this journey?
Oh, yes, definitely. I would like to first and foremost thank my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I'd like to thank my family, who is very supportive. Navy's number one gas turbine shop, which is our gas turbine shop here at Marmac. And then also my Marmac STEM team. And last but not least, my church that I serve as well at.
And what's the name of that church?
It's the Norfolk Potter's House.
Finally, what's next for you, personally first?
Personally, it took a while, but I'm actually going to be graduating in August with a bachelor's degree in business admin. So I'm looking forward to flying out to San Antonio. I'm going to the Incarnate Word that's in San Antonio. I'm going to go be walking for my graduation. Also going to be the first person within my immediate family to get a bachelor's degree. So definitely excited about that. Professionally, I'm looking actually to get into recruiting. So I'm hoping to see if a billet opens up to kind of get stationed there for my last tour.
Thanks for sharing all this information. Quite an interesting career you have ahead of you. If you would share with the listeners your favorite podcast.
Oh, it has to be Marmac Maintainers Podcast.
There you go.
Thanks, Chief, for setting an example and for reminding us all we have the power to make a difference in our community. It shows up every day in how we lead, serve, and take care of others. And that is a wrap on this episode of the Maintainer Podcast. So many people contribute to the work done here at Marmac every single day, and no matter what you do, your work makes a difference, and we could not complete our mission without you. In the field and in the office, on land and by sea, both near and far, these stories all point to one thing. Readiness is built by people who care deeply about the mission and each other. Before we go, I'll pass it over to a few of our shipmates to help close us out.
This is MM3 Warren.
This is YN1 Paloma.
This is BMC Hosford.
The Maintainer Podcast is produced by Marmac Public Affairs Office.
Follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching
Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center.
You can also check out the Marmac News and Events page on SharePoint
to stay current with everything happening around the command.
If you have an idea for a future episode,
or if your team is doing something the command needs to hear about,
drop us a line at Public Affairs.
We'd love to hear from you.
We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, fair winds and following seas. I'm Jared Patch, and this has been the Maintainer Podcast.
Yeah, man. Easy peasy, squeezy lemons.